things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the right side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show, keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
Come on, cheer up.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
First things out to sea, you know.
Incidentally, this record's available in the foyer.
Right,
some of us got to live as well, you know. What do you think pays for all this rubbish? I told him, Bernie, I'll never make that money back.
Yeah, always look on the bright side of life. That's right. You better do that, because if you don't, you can't keep up with this game. Terrible time of year in the bunker right here in north central Indiana. And I don't know what I'm laughing about. I got an arm that feels like it's falling off. I had to go in and get it looked at today, but I don't know. I guess got a nerve problem there or something. But anyhow, we're going and we're going to do the show anyhow. To hell with them. We're at P.O. Box 401. And we got a whole fistful of mail today from all you people, and that's good. Like to keep it at the first, or the first week anyhow, because my figuring gets screwed up later on. Yeah. Yeah, well, let's see. What are we going to do today? Oh. Let me think. I'll come up with some shit. I mean, something good. I did a bad thing yesterday. Yesterday was my mama's birthday, Groundhog Day. That's normally, I never forget it on Groundhog Day. And but anyhow, it was the second. But today is February the 3rd, 2015, Tears Day, all day. Well, I got bad news for all you hippity-hopperers out there. The Black Ku Klux Klan has struck again. Oakland rapper Jackie, that's J-A-C-K-A, came to an early death this week, with a lot of fans around the country mourning his passing. He, too, was a victim of the Black Ku Klux Klan, which affects so many black men in America. The rapper, whose real name is Dominic Newton got his start with the group Mob Figures in the 1990s, eventually becoming a solo artist. The Twitter hashtag was #RipJacka, has circulated around social media as people mourn his passing. Black people, that is, according to the San Jose Mercury News. Fans of a popular Bay Area rapper were in mourning Tuesday after police said the singer was shot and killed overnight in East Oakland, probably by the notorious Black KKK. Rapper Dominic Newton, known by the stage name as Jacka, died after being shot in the 9400 block of MacArthur Boulevard on Monday night, police said. Police confirmed his identity Tuesday morning. The shooting occurred around 8:15 p.m. Rapper Vigilante brings some real perspective on what negative music and lifestyle can do to the future of young black men. According to Vigilante, hip-hop artists have to think about what the industry is doing to the African-American community. He says that the violence is being glorified and affecting the way black men respond to one another, and it encourages the Black Ku Klux Klan. With the glorification only worsening, the effects of missing jobs and weak educational system. Well, you might add into that a weak brain, too, in many cases. Well, I don't want to bore you too much here, but actually sort of exciting. Rapper Akon, A-K-O-N, he's from Africa, and he's saying, go back home to Africa, is what he's saying. Let me see here what else he's saying. Akon hasn't been in the spotlight for quite some time. It's been over half a decade since the Sinhalese-born rapper has released an album, and many believed he simply faded away. But Akon hasn't gone anywhere. He was recently spotted voicing his opinion on social issues. The artist was recently on the Al Jazeera TV channel, where he sat down with host Fally Ba Thibault to talk about matters surrounding the recent rise in racial tensions that have gripped the nation. Yeah. And the protests that were being held in cities across the country. Akon acknowledges that the frustrations are being felt by the protesters and marchers, and added that the African Americans needed to broaden their horizons. He said the system in America was not built for black people. Quote, I always felt like Africa was for Africans, unquote. The five-time Grammy nominee said, quote, so when I see African Americans in America dealing with all these issues, my first question is, quote, why don't they just go back home, back to Africa? That's what Akon says. Quote, how many African Americans do you know who actually consider Africa as a vacation spot? Unquote. Akon went on to ask, even if it's just for knowledge, just to know where they came from, just to get an idea of what that is. Quote, there is so much fear instilled in them that they wouldn't even want to go there to visit. You mention Africa and they start shaking, unquote. Akon went on to say that on the contrary, they as Americans would actually find preferential treatment and soon realize that Africa wasn't as bad as it's portrayed to be, especially for blacks. He also says he is still on the music scene, although he operates behind the scenes and has been producing music for other artists, but now he's planning and working on a new five-part concept album. Sounds like this guy's got his head screwed on straight, and he's the blackest Negro you ever want to see, saying, hey, this country's not for you. Go back to Africa. Africa is for African, black Africans. Okay. Boy, he's going to get in trouble. The Jews won't like that. They don't want their money going out of the country. They don't like their, what do you call it? Their suckers, they've lined it up, or their meal tickets. They don't want to lose those black meal tickets, baby. Hey, did you know the Koch brothers, those Republicans, spent over $1 billion last year in the election? And you think you're going to go down there, you little, and vote these guys out? Where the Koch brothers are putting $1 billion into the campaigns? Ho, 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 ho. The days of voting anything out is over. Well, what do you think about this? Poor guy, $42,000 were raised for a factory worker who walks 21 miles to work. Transportation can be an enormous impediment in getting to and from work, especially in cities that aren't computer or commuter friendly. One Detroit man, however, doesn't let the distance keep him away from his factory job. Factory worker James Robinson, 56, walks 21 miles round trip to his job at an industrial molding plant. Although he catches the bus, it only takes him part of the route to his job. Robertson only earns a little over $10 an hour and says that's not enough to buy a car, but he's not bitter. The factory worker who works for a company that produces parts for the maker of Humvee cars says he enjoys his co-workers and his job, and his boss says Robertson's always at work and doesn't make excuses. Isn't that nice of you, Mr. Boss? Gotta walk nearly 21 miles a day to keep a lousy $10 an hour job. That's the way it's going, boys and girls. That's the way it's going. And that's exactly the way the Republican Party and half the Democrat Party and the Koch brothers like it. Get used to it. Well, let's do something unforgivable. I'm going to go over to the left wing now and listen for a while. You ought to listen, too. You're not going to hear this stuff on most of these right-wing conservative programs. They'll be on the other side wanting to promote TPP, this trade agreement in the Pacific, which is 100 times worse than NAFTA. I wonder if you go down there to some of these right-wing racial websites, do you ever hear any of this kind of stuff? No, you hear Jew, 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 nigger, 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 nigger. That's all you're going to hear. Or Hitler's great, Hitler's great, Hitler's great, and all that stuff. Well, anyhow, I'm playing this. You call up all your right-wing friends and say, Metzger is going crazy. He is a Bolshevik. I could prove it. But as you'll hear on this clip, there's some people out there doing something. They go into these meetings in Washington and tell them off loud, man. And these guys can't take it. These goddamn senators and congressmen can't take it. They're yellow bellies.
Roman's testimony before Congress yesterday. Here's the conclusion of his testimony, and then we'll comment some more.
Legislation was passed over a decade ago. An updated TPA bill is needed to address the rise of the digital economy, the increasing role of SOEs, and to reflect the latest congressional views on labor, environment, innovation, and access to medicines. TPA also establishes the timeline and process for the trade agreements we bring home to be reviewed not only by Congress, but also by the American people. TPA is Congress's best tool to ensure that there is ample time for public scrutiny and debate on U.S. trade agreements. And the administration looks forward to working with this committee and the new Congress as a whole to secure a TPA that has bipartisan support. We also look forward to working with Congress to renew a number of other programs, including trade adjustment assistance, the Generalized System of Preferences, which expired in 2013, and the AGOA program well before its expiration in September of this year. We can only accomplish these shared goals and priorities through strong bipartisan cooperation between Congress and the administration. Together, we can ensure that our trade policy continues unlocking opportunity for all Americans.
So there was Michael Froman's statement. There was his opener to the committee. And let's just discuss a few elements of it for a second. First, he said at one point, and we let it brush aside, but I wanted to come back to it, that since 2009, America's exports have grown by nearly 50% and contributed one-third to our economic growth. Now, let's go over some facts. In 2013, which is the last year on record, do you know how much our exports grew? Zero. A year before that, they increased by 2%. You know, the administration had a goal of doubling U.S. exports from 2009 to 2014. And most of the growth that Froman is citing has nothing to do with increasing trade, has more to do with the global economy recovering. So the idea that we need to increase our export rate is somehow and that TPP will do that. Do you really think suddenly factories will be set up here? Is that what happened after NAFTA? Did all those factories stay here and we increased our exports and the world was bright and shiny? Is that what occurred? I don't recall. I don't have memories of that moment. Do you? Do you remember what happened there? Because I don't. I am utterly, utterly confused by it. Because as I recall, now tell me if I'm wrong, but, you know, a lot of our jobs got shipped off to Mexico because of NAFTA, and that was never going to happen. And remember, the president had said during his first campaign that, you know, his priority was to renegotiate NAFTA, to take out the bad provisions. What TPP will do is make it worse. Now, this is the other thing. Froman said, he said, at a time when too many workers haven't seen their paychecks grow, export-related jobs typically pay 18% more on average than non-export-related jobs. That's great, except what he didn't mention was that the reason workers haven't seen their paychecks grow is because NAFTA incentivized offshoring. And this is thank you, Public Citizen, for providing us with this information, of U.S. manufacturing jobs. And that has put a huge downward pressure on wages. So, look, I've said this before, I'm going to say it again, I'm going to keep talking about it till I'm blue in the face, I'm going to talk about it all the time. I don't care whether you care or not, because you gotta care. This is one of those things where I'm just gonna push, because you have to care about it. If you're a progressive, if you believe in a good environment, good paying jobs, good regulation of Wall Street, if you believe in any of those things, which my sense is most of us do, the most important thing we can do this year, the only thing we can, if we care about those three things and a million more, the most progressive thing you can focus on this year, that we're red alert, the triage unit is going, right? There are other progressive issues that are important, but none of them will be settled this year. TPP, we got this year. If they don't get it done this year, it's not getting done. If they don't get this done in the next 12 months, this ain't happening. And we have no choice. We have really no choice. We had a tweet from DC sports artist saying, this conservative is liking how Ari Rabinoff is kicking ass on the TPP and NAFTA on XM. Yeah, look, this isn't a liberal conservative issue. Conservatives, look, I gave you three reasons why progressives should be up in arms. Conservatives, I don't expect conservatives to like Wall Street regulations, environmental regulations, minimum wage. That's not your bag, baby. But I do expect you, conservatives hate the idea, abhor the idea of global governance, abhor the idea of the inability of local governments, of cities, towns, and states to set their own regulations based on what their own people want at the control of multinationals, at the control of a global governance. And that's exactly what the TPP does. It allows boards of corporate lawyers with loyalties to no country telling your state what laws they can pass. And conservatives should be up in arms about that. Conservatives should hate that. Conservatives should despise that. Conservatives should make conservatives sick. And also, by the way, conservatives shouldn't want fast track, because didn't you guys just run a huge campaign about how this president was the imperial president who has too much power, and how we can't give him any more power because he just takes advantage of all the power? And then the first big thing you're actually going to pass, the first big thing you're actually going to do is trade promotion authority, which essentially gives the president a clear shot at doing whatever he wants on trade. So basically, oh, the president's an imperial president, but what we're going to do is allow him to legislate whatever he wants through this trade treaty. And here's the thing. I don't know. This is one of those issues on TPP. I know corporations. I know professionals. I know lobbyists who are pro-TPP. I actually have never met a single American in favor of TPP who's not a Washington insider or somebody who does, like, corporate trade work. I don't know a single average American who says, you know what, I really think what we need is this big global trade treaty with all these countries. And look, what the TPP is about, let's be clear, is about countering Chinese influence in Asia. That is the national security upside of it. But is it worth all these sacrifices? Let's talk to Lee in Los Angeles. Lee, what's going on?
Well, it's too bad. I had another clip that had all these people that put themselves inside this conference room, this hearing room, and tore them a new asshole, screaming and yelling and everything else about the truth about TPP. Now, all the conservatives are going to be, or most of them, are going to be voting for this, and it's a disaster. It's a disaster. You got about 12 months to get it out of the way. And here's where people got to learn, at least the people who are listening to me, you got to get the information where you can get it, and you have to work with people on the issue you can work with them on. Now, these progressives, you're not going to, well, you may be able to convince some of them, but right now you're not going to convince them about the race issue. And maybe not too much about the Jew issue, except for Israel and Palestine. But you can work with them on the finance situation and the corruption in the White House and the corruption in Wall Street and all that. And you can get along fine. Well, that builds contacts. And instead of sitting like the right wing does on their thumb, and they got about two or three points of interest they keep yapping about, and then also spend all their time back in World War II and beyond that, we got to learn to work with people on what we can work with them on. And that's my opinion. What's the right wing got to lose coming across and working a little bit with the left? What do they got to lose? They're not winning anything. They're not going anywhere. But probably they'd screw it up, so I wish maybe they'd stay over there on that stupid ball field where every time the Koch brothers and the big money people want them to vote their way, say, oh, man, they're going to take your guns away. Oh, they're going to abort your kids. You're not going to be able to pray to the Jew God in the school. Oh, it's terrible. Meanwhile, they're robbing you blind. Robbing you blind. Now, Free Speech TV is on most of the cable units and XM and so forth, and they're very, very left and hate racist guts. But they've got some smart people on there about other issues. Now, if you go up to freespeech.com and look up the Dizzy Awards or Izzy Awards, and there's one good one there about with Jeffrey Scahill, who's a reporter, telling you what they're doing to reporters that want to really report what's going on around the world. And they're throwing them in jail and persecuting them and torturing them and everything else. So there's some other stuff up there, too. So look around. Don't just get stuck on, what's that fat ass's name? I can't remember. Anyhow, that big fat ass that's up there and blowing off all the time, that right winger. And if you're still listening to him, even though, sure, once in a while he says something that's true, but generally, he's in the pocket, baby. He is in the pocket, or he wouldn't be on there. Do you remember that Republican congressman or senator, Jody Ernst, I think her name was, that was yapping about going to school with plastic bread wrappers around her feet because she didn't have hardly any money, and it was horrible and terrible. Do you know what her family takes down in government subsidies on agriculture and so forth? $500,000 in a year. Yeah, this poor little girl had to put plastic around her feet to walk to school. Her family, her uncles, everybody's in on it. $500,000 a year. Subsidy. Welfare for the rich. And her uncle took down $300,000 last year. And my congressman, Marvin Stutzman, he gets over $1,000, maybe $2,000 or $3,000. I'm not quite sure. I haven't checked lately. For not growing things. And yet, he's right out front when they're talking about poor people getting welfare. Or out there saying if they smoke a joint, they're not going to get any welfare. Now, what they need to do is drug test every one of these bastards in Congress and the Senate every morning before they go in there and see how that works out for them. Well, look what's happened. Did you miss this? They've got a new unit, a radar unit. I think it looks like it can be handheld. They can see right through your walls and see where you're at in the house and what you're doing. They can even hear you breathing. Yeah, and the cops all want them. They're going like hotcakes. So breaking and entering, forget that's old hat. Now they can just point that thing at your house and know quite a bit about everything you're doing. Boy, isn't it wonderful? Don't we love the police state? Well, boys and girls, I'm going to have to cut it down. That's 27, 28 minutes of the show today because I've got to doctor my arm. And I'll be back tomorrow. The Gimper. Yeah. Okay, 14.5, five words. I have nothing to say. Won't hurt you at all. Well, let me close out, though, with a segment of Kaiser and find out what the world of money is like right now.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. The French novelist André Malraux said, "Man is not what he thinks he is. He is what he hides." And sometimes in the case of a nation like Greece, it is what others attempt to hide. Insolvency, bankruptcy, bust. No can pay. No money. No God, no money. We're broke. We're broke. We're broke. Stacey?
Max.
Yeah.
Yes, we're back from Mexico. You took all these weeks to just come up with that final.
That's it.
And we went via New York where there was a fake blizzard.
Oh, that fake blizzard was a joke.
But nowhere is more fake than here in London. We've been hit with propaganda, anti-Russia propaganda, anti-Greece propaganda.
What about that Guardian piece?
Exactly. But we're going to talk about Greece now because this is the big story of this first half, because one thing that happened when we were away as a frequent guest of Kaiser Report, Yanis Varoufakis has become like this rock star of Greece. Apparently, when he showed up for the first day of work at the finance ministry in Greece, he's a new finance minister, there were thousands of screaming girls, according to The Guardian, just screaming as he showed up. Well, he has the establishment certainly screaming in a very condescending way, and they don't want to, they're angry at his honesty, his truth-telling. The headline reads, "New finance minister says Greece is insolvent." And he was interviewed by Emily Matlis of BBC Newsnight. And in it, he explained that why they're renegotiating, what they want to talk to their European partners about, and is that basically, he's saying, like, I'm like a bankrupt friend, pretend, and I have a credit card. People want to keep on giving me loans. But he said, quote, "Would you advise them that they should continue to take these tranches of loans from the credit card in order to deal with what is essentially an insolvency problem?" And as Francis Coppola notes, Emily Matlis didn't follow up on that. She didn't even, like, pick up on the fact that here's the finance minister saying Greece is insolvent. This is the issue. Nobody has mentioned this. Nobody wants to say it.
Yeah, well, it is an insolvency issue, and the BBC completely glossed over it, and Lehman Brothers was an insolvency issue. RBS was an insolvency issue. HSBC was an insolvency issue. Barclays Bank is an insolvency issue. They position it as a liquidity issue that requires bailouts. And those bailouts are financed by central bank interest rates at zero or now negative interest rates. 16% of all the world's sovereign debt is now producing negative interest rates. And Yanis, over there, finance minister of Greece, is bringing to the fore a truth that has been ignored now since 2008. That, one, the global economy is bankrupt. Two, banks like Barclays, HSBC, Lloyds, RBS are technically insolvent. They are insolvent institutions. The Bank of England is also insolvent. The Federal Reserve Bank is insolvent. So Greece is saying, you guys are insolvent, and we're also insolvent, but you want to pay your rolling zombie bank debt by selling off our assets in a highly destructive way. Remember, Goldman Sachs was in there, destroyed Greece for the benefit of John Paulson, the hedge fund, and Papandreou, who was caught stealing funds. So he makes a good point, and he's in the catbird seat because he is dealing in reality, and these other guys are dealing in fantasy.
Well, just to put this into context, less than 10% of all those so-called bailout funds actually went to Greece. The rest, about 90%, went to those banks of France, of Germany, of other nations where they would have been the ones that
were bailed out. The creditors were bailed out.
The creditors were bailed out. Even J.P. Morgan notes that. J.P. Morgan noted that only 15 billion euros of the 410 billion, some of that was then lowered, but of that, only 15 billion went to Greece. So,
look, I've been on the TV with Yanis many times on many networks and interviewed him on many of my own shows. And we've been talking about this for 6 years. So it should be no surprise that Osborne and Cameron and Merkel, the truth that he is speaking, the only reason they'd be shocked by this is because they live in a deluded world of BBC propaganda where they think these banks are not insolvent. That's the direct result of BBC propaganda. Now, Yanis is saying, shatter your propaganda and understand that we're in the catbird seat. And if Germany doesn't take our debt, renegotiate our debt, don't go to Russia. Russia will be happy to renegotiate their debt.
So let's turn to what Francis Coppola says about this. So everyone knows Greece is insolvent, of course, but no one has ever stated it officially. The Troika's position is that Greece's problem is a temporary liquidity shortfall. Lending it more money so it can meet current debt service obligations is justified because structural reforms will lead to renewed growth and increased income, enabling it to meet its obligations, including those for the new loans in the future. But Varoufakis disagrees with this interpretation. His view is that while things remain as they are, Greece will never recover. The bailout program locks it into a debt deflationary spiral, which simultaneously reduces its income and increases its debt burden. Continuing to accept more loans in order to meet debt service obligations only makes matters worse. So this is the truth of what he's seeing and what he's saying. And you mentioned Papandreou. Actually, his name is Papandreou. And this is one of the things that also Emily Matsalis and the BBC are very upset about, is that apparently for the first time since democracy returned post-1974, this is the first time that Papandreou has not been in the government. So we like, you know, our establishment media likes the Clintons, likes the Bushes, likes these family oligarchies that are in power, and only they have the legitimacy to go and renegotiate debt or not renegotiate debt, as it were.
Right, well, look, BBC is a state-run media outlet that presents the views of the British state, first and foremost. They're not impartial.
Well, there's
loads
of state media. RT is a state media. BBC is state media. France 24 is state media. Al Jazeera is state media.
Yeah, well, look, Stacey, in The Guardian today, there's an editorial saying that the BBC needs to be propagandized for murdering Russian people. This was an editorial in today's Guardian, that the BBC should propagandize to murder Russians, just like they did to propagandize and murder Iraqis. That's so absurd.
So you're talking about Timothy Garton-Ash, and he's talking about we need to have a war. So a violent conflict with guns. So, but let's talk about this financial war that has been going on in Greece. And again, here we turn to a tweet from Philippe Legrain, and he's the author of European Spring, Why Our Economies and Politics Are in a Mess and How to Put Them Right. And he tweets this about the situation that we see in front of us that you and I see, that most people see, but the likes of the mainstream media, and the BBC is state media, but they're mainstream media. CNN is mainstream media. These are the guys that take the corporate position, what the corporatocracy and the oligarchy of our states want them to present. So he's saying Germans need to be told the truth, that their loans to Greece were primarily bailouts of its creditors, notably German banks. So many, the German population is what he's saying are basically, because they're not being told the truth, Merkel is in a position where she cannot act honestly in a situation. It's just a contractual issue.
And one of the things that we need to get clear is that when a bond lender, when somebody loans money via a bond offering, a Wall Street bank, a City of London bank, a government, if that bond cannot be paid by the borrower, both parties are equally culpable or equally involved in this transaction, in this contract. That's why in the bond market, there's something called the interest rate, and the interest rate is tied to risk. Now, the loans that were made to Greece were done so at an interest rate commensurate with the risk. The fact that Greece can't pay, you have two parties. The Greek government is now renegotiating that debt, and the people who made those loans have to accept the fact they have to cowboy up, they have to man up, and say, we made a bad bet. The state and the people do not bail out bankers like they did in Ireland shamelessly.
Well, in fact, I would disagree that they were paid for the risk. Everybody notes that, well, Greece was lucky to join the euro, because what happened when they joined the euro is that their interest rates on their sovereign bonds went down. Is that the fault of Greece, or is it the fault of the lenders who mispriced that risk? They assumed Germany would bail them out. That's why they were willing to lend to Greece at 4% rather than, say, 10 or 11 or 12%, which would have compensated them for the risk.
Well, they went right in that they coerced the ECB, which is the old Bundesbank, the German central bank, and Mario Draghi. He said, as we predicted on the show 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, 6 months ago, and 3 months ago, that he would acquiesce and he would open the ECB balance sheet up to €1 trillion of new debt.
Yes, we
okay,
did.
Everyone
you
said that
yes.
was never going to happen. We said it was a dead certainty it would happen. And this is what the PIMCO bond traders of the world are banking on, is that they can go to a place like Davos, take Mario Draghi in the back room, put a gun to his head, and say, take €1 trillion in debt, we're going to blow your brains all over the ceiling. Like that was done with Corzine and Jamie Dimon. Remember, Jamie put a gun to Corzine's head and say, either give us our $1 billion or your brains are on the ceiling. That's pretty well known and documented at this point. So,
well, rhetorically, yes. So let's also talk about the fact that you said that there are the two parties to a contract. But in this case of Greece, in the case of Ireland, what is truly happened is that the individual citizens of the nation were not party to the contract, and yet they're being held responsible. And this is why we see these anti-austerity protests around the world, is because people realize they're being made to pay for private contracts done between these, the likes of Bill Gross. And I say Bill Gross not necessarily because I know that he's individually involved in these, but he ran PIMCO, which is the largest bond fund in the world, or was the largest bond fund in the world. So these are like the smartest guys in the room, very well compensated, paid hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Presumably, for their compensation, they understand the risk they are taking with their investors' money. And here we have elected officials, sometimes unelected officials across Europe, who are taking on these debts for their nation. And in the case of Greece, we're hiding it with the help of Goldman Sachs, which used some various interest rate swaps and credit default swaps to hide all their debt. Well, here, the citizens, the taxpayers, are not party to these contracts. They don't know who was taking on this debt and what their responsibilities were.
Look, there's a huge lawsuit in Greece against Goldman Sachs by the Lawyers Association in Greece. I spoke to them a few years ago and gave a presentation about why Goldman Sachs is culpable in these financial acts of terrorism and that they should be sued. And I hope that they follow up on that lawsuit, because Goldman Sachs' fingerprints are all over this collapse. And Yanis Varoufakis...
Well, that's what we said, is like what right now everybody's strong-arming Greece into paying them for these, the bondholders for paying these debts, the bailouts and stuff. But you and I were saying when we were watching this on BBC Newsnight is, why aren't people going to Goldman Sachs? Goldman Sachs is the one that engineered the lie, the original lie. You're talking about what's hidden is what is the truth about a country. And what was hidden... Who hid it was Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs hid Greece's debt. It wasn't the fault of anybody but Goldman Sachs in terms of people not understanding the risk they were taking.
Right, and of course the BBC doesn't go down that path because they're state-run propagandists. in bed with the corporations. I mean, that point needs to be made because everyone's pushing them as being some impartial global voice of sanity, but they're not. They're now.
We have to go to the second half. Go to the second half. I'm staying.
Stay tuned for the second half. A whole lot more. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. I'm here with Stacey Herbert. So, yeah, we're talking about Greece. Greece shouldn't be a shock to anyone. It shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. We've been saying this for years. They are an insolvent country, but so are the banks that made loans to Greece. The thing that Greece has is they've got a huge income-producing assets. They've got a huge tourist industry. They've got a great economy, and they're going to survive and thrive post-apocalypse, financial apocalypse. And, you know, it's just this is not a surprise. Anyone who thinks it's a surprise hasn't been watching the news.
And so we were talking about what is hidden and how that defines what a person is. And in the case of Greece, it's insolvent and its debts were hidden. Now we're going to turn to America, where there's a similar story of unwittingly bankrupt people. And this is, while Deflategate and Kategate rage, America quietly robs its elderly. And this is Matt Taibbi, and he's in the Rolling Stone magazine, and he's talking about the Ferris wheel of conflicted payments. And so apparently many Americans don't realize, it might surprise a lot of Americans to know that most brokers handling retirement funds aren't required by law to act in the best interest of their clients. So they don't have to act in your best interest. You give them money, and they don't actually have to work toward making you more money. In fact, their primary obligation is often, in fact, to make themselves more money. So they might put you, for example, in some sort of investment in which they're receiving a huge kickback.
Yeah, okay. Do you want my comment on this?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I worked as a stockbroker for many years. I worked for Payne Weber, Oppenheimer & Company, Shearson Lehman Hutton, and Alex Brown. And they are all exactly the same. They pay brokers based on return on assets, which they define as the percentage of a client's accounts you convert into a commission. Okay? Listen to what I just said. If you give me $1 million to manage, I get paid, I'm compensated by what percentage of that $1 million I can turn into a commission fee. Okay? Now, a good broker at any of these firms will convert 5 to 6% of an asset of a customer into a commission. That they churn them, they burn them, they pilfer, like they do at Jamie Dimon. Does this every day, except he does it on a global basis. And they love him for it. But they, and then an excellent broker will steal 10% or churn 10% or convert 10% of that client money into a commission, into a fee. That's how they're paid. That's how they're structured. It never, ever, ever in any conversation I've ever had in my years and years as a stockbroker with all those major firms did anyone ever ask, are the customers making money? As a matter of fact, there's a standard industry joke called, where are the customers' yachts? The brokers have the yachts. The customers get kicked in the teeth.
And so this was actually presented to Barack Obama. They wrote that back on January 13th, Jason Furman, the chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, issued a scathing memo about shady broker practices and how they impact ordinary savers, especially working people who use brokers to manage their retirement funds. So none of the media covered it. Instead, they covered this. There was a football game, an American football, and some Deflategate. They said the ball was deflated and it made the Patriots win. Whatever. That was what people were focusing on, not the deflation of your retirement fund. And they mentioned this churning. And Matt Taibbi compares it to the Wolf of Wall Street. There's a scene where Leonardo DiCaprio joins this brokerage firm, and Matthew McConaughey plays his boss. And he says, you know, there's three ways to succeed as a broker. One is a vulgar thing. Two is cocaine, and three is revolution. Revolution, not in the way of these anti-austerity protests or Arab Springs or uprisings, but what the revolution is churning. Put them on a Ferris wheel and keep churning your clients and churning and churning and churning revolution into and out of investments that aren't in their best interest, but in our best interest.
Well, Wall Street in the 80s covered the same material. Boiler Room. It's another movie, 10 or 15 years later, covered the same area. Wolf of Wall Street covered the same topic. Okay, for the past 30 years, we've known that brokers churn and steal money from clients. And here's why it never goes anywhere. Occasionally, a broker will sue their brokerage firm or their broker. And then you have two responses. Number one, you give them shares in a hot IPO. That's why IPOs are priced at 20 or 30 or 40% discount to what they could get if they priced it correctly, because they use that first day pop as a payola to keep litigious clients quiet. That's why you see all those one-day pops on IPOs. They're used as payola to keep litigious clients quiet. Number two, if a client won't take the bribe from the brokerage firm in the form of a hot IPO and they want to go to court, well, when you sign a new customer account at any one of these brokerage firms, you sign up to binding arbitration. You can't go to a court of law and face a jury. You must go to arbiters. And those arbiters are made up of brokers and bankers. That's why for every – this, I read a study a couple of years ago. For every $1,000 that's stolen from clients through the practices that you're talking about, less than $1 is recovered because they face a panel of brokers who, of course, side with the brokerage firm.
And, of course, that's part of the TPP and the TTIP sort of deals. These sovereigns want to sign up to this same exact sort of arbitration where they'll always be guaranteed to lose.
But let's tie this to Greece for a second. Greece is the victim, just like a customer of one of these firms featured in one of these films is a victim. They were sold crap from Goldman Sachs that bankrupted the nation. And where is their recourse? They had to go to the Troika, which is an arbitration panel made up of shysters.
Yeah.
And they got no redress. So now they elected a new government, and the BBC and other outlets will say they're far left, they're radical, they won't pay the bondholders. And pure propaganda, even though they're the ones who have been victimized, the Greek people, just like the people in Spain have been victimized. The people in Ireland have been so unmercifully victimized by the Troika and other scallywags in the banking industry, it makes the Catholic pedophile church scandal look lame by comparison.
So they also talk about this practice of churning. So the memo that was given to President Obama, the particular practice of making a client pay endlessly for transaction fees within the fund, known as churning, is described as a serious problem, one in which brokers, quote, repeatedly buy and sell assets when additional transactions aren't necessary while exhibiting poor market timing. But as you've said, too, this wasn't covered in the President Obama's memo, is that they intentionally do that. They put on the trades early in the morning. The losing ones they dump on their clients, and the winning ones they keep for themselves or their favored clients.
Well, look, the fact is that, as Warren Buffett will tell you, the most successful investor in history, he gets maybe 3 or 4 good ideas a year. That's it. That's the most he can hope for. A stockbroker, to keep going, has to come up with 3 or 4 ideas a day. They'll call the same client 3 times a day with 3 great ideas. Statistically, that's impossible. And every time you lose, you enter in what's called the arithmetic of losing. If you lose 10% in an account, you have to make way more than 10% on the remaining funds to get back to even. So you take more risk, which of course means you're going to even lose more money. That's point number one. Point number two is that, as you point out, you engage in fraud in a couple of different ways. People don't understand where these commissions come from. They call up, for example, the over-the-counter desk or the OTC desk, which is a syndicate of NASDAQ professionals who make markets and stocks. And you take down, let's say, 500,000 shares at a price that is distributed throughout the firm. But then when you call customers, you add – they mark it up essentially on the NASDAQ, and they create a fake price. And the difference is essentially a commission. So the broker would take – sometimes the customer gets a confirm, which shows you bought stock at $12. They don't understand that the desk at the firm, whether it's Oppenheimer or J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs, they bought it at $10, and they just marked it up 20% before they print the ticket for the customer. 2 days later, it's back to 10 bucks, and the customer's down 20%, and he doesn't think he paid a dollar in commission. He got hosed. He got f***ed by 20%. By the collusion of the trading desk, the brokers, the management, the sales manager, the CEO of these firms. They all collude. They all get kickbacks. They all take a piece of the dough. All that money goes into the big fat Christmas bonuses. And the compliance officers at these firms get the biggest Christmas bonus of all at the end of the year because they're the most corrupt. Every single one of these offices has a compliance officer. And those guys sign on every single corrupt act. They all should be in jail.
So let's also focus on the fact of what is hidden and what is hidden that is the truth about the situation, but you don't know. So in the case, say, Americans, especially the Fox News watching sort, were very aggressively for the fact that the kid in Ferguson, Missouri, should deserve to die because he stole a cigarette. He stole a cigarette That's why he's dead. He stole a cigarette. That's why he's dead. Here, we're going to put a number on how much is stolen from you, the American people, by your brokerages. Well, Barack Obama knows this because it's in his memo. They put the losses at between $8 and $17 billion per year. Down to the individual level, what it means for you, the individual, an investor receiving conflicted advice, which you are because all brokerages are conflicted, who expects to retire in 30 years, loses at least 5 to 10% of his or her potential retirement savings due to conflicts, or approximately 1 to 3 years worth of withdrawals during retirement. And yet those same people watching Fox News, and I have a lot of family who watch Fox News and tell me, stop bashing bankers. Bankers are great. Brokers are great. And here, they're stealing 3 years of your income. And you're like...
Well, you mentioned pension accounts.
Yeah.
They're known as Wall Street, on Wall Street, as dumb money. And here's the great thing about pension accounts. Let's say I just engage in a transaction that I'm being sued for. And the customer wants to... take us to court, and he's getting all upset, and he won't take the IPO bribe. Here's another recourse that the brokerage can do. They'll bust the trade. They'll put that loss into the error account of the firm, and then they'll call up a pension fund who they know the manager of that fund, and they'll say, you know, you were in the teacher's pension fund or the fireman's pension fund or the pension fund for all these municipal workers. It's a huge multi-billion-dollar fund. And they're made up of stupid people that never check their balances. They're dumb, blue-collar workers. We're going to dump this losing trade in that account. You're going to take the loss. We need to bury it. And by the way, here's a nice bottle of champagne. Here's a nice hooker. Here's a nice night out in the town. That's what they go for.
Yeah, but bring it back to the first half of the show with Greece. Here, these individual Americans don't know, but in 30 years' time, when they retire, they're going to have a lot less than what they thought they had. Same with the Greek people. And what's going to happen? Emily Matlis, the BBC is going to hate you. They're going to vilify you. You're the ones that made the bad choices. Not that you were robbed blind for this entire time and nobody protected you, because there's no reason that the brokerages have any sort of reason to have your interest at heart.
Right. Emily would blame the rape victim. Let's be honest about it. She would blame the victim of financial rape. And the number of ways that this goes on, I could go on for another hour and describe 20 or 30 different ways that Wall Street and the City of London... But the point is this, that Greece is the victim of this type of financial rape, financial terrorism. And now, thank God, there is somebody like Iceland who's fighting back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we give them our 100% support. And if European ECB won't take their bonds, Russia will take the bonds, and they'll negotiate with Germany, and they'll use gas as a currency. So we got your back, Greece. We got your back. All right, Stacey, thanks so much. We got to go.
Thanks, Max.